I'm Trisha Helfer, and you are listening to After the Credits at row3.com. Let's begin. Party on, party people, let me hear some noise. DC's in the house, jump, jump, rejoice. There's a party over here, a party over there. Wave your hands in the air, shake the dairy, yeah. These three words mean you're getting busy. Whoop, there it is, hit me. Whoop.
Show all you folks what it's all about. Now it's time for me to get on the mic and make this tag team party hype. I'm taking it back to the old school, cause I'm an old fool who's so cool. If you wanna get down, I'ma show you the way. Woo, there it is, let me hear you say.
Welcome to another episode of After the Credits, and I am your host, Marina Ann Tunes. Podcast co-host Dale McGladdery recently had a chance to speak with director Brett Gaylor about his new film, a documentary titled RIP, A Remix Manifesto. RIP has been making the festival rounds for the last couple of months and doing quite well, winning the prestigious International Documentary Festival in Amsterdam, and the film just also finished screening at the Whistler Film Festival, where it won the Audience Choice Award and honorable mention for Best Documentary. It's a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hi, Brett. Thanks for talking to me today.
Dale, I'm super excited about it.
Excellent. Now, the reason we're talking is you have a new movie on the festival circuit.
Yeah, it's called RIP, A Remix Manifesto. And it's basically about the fight between the copyleft, which are the people who want to protect the public domain, and the copyright, who are the corporations that want to lock up ideas and sell them. And the film follows a musician named Girl Talk, who makes new music out of rearranging other people's pre-recorded music and calling it his own song. But that's illegal, and it's illegal for me to show it in a film. So I need advice from people like Lawrence Lessig, who founded Creative Commons, and sort of culture jamming figures like Negative Land and Cory Doctorow, and we get inspiration from Brazil and their minister of culture, Gilberto Gil. And the film looks at how culture belongs to everybody, and how we are all agents in the creation of art and culture.
Well, and I was impressed. It's one of the most articulate and entertaining explanations of the issues around copyright and culture that I've seen. So good job on that.
Well, thank you, Dale. That's very polite of you to say so.
Oh, <it's not laughs>
I know
polite.
It's early for you.
How did the idea for the documentary come together for you?
It took a really long time. I mean, it's not unusual for a doc that sort of covers this much ground to take several years, but mine took a really long time. It took 6 years to put together.
Because you mentioned Girl Talk. I mean, like, were you just kind of sitting in your apartment listening to Girl Talk one day saying, I need to explore this in film, or...
Yeah, I mean, well, Girl Talk and I had been sort of online friends for quite a few years, but it was only sort of once I'd sort of decided that I wanted music to be the central way into the issue. I knew that I didn't really want to focus so much just on the sort of downloading aspect and what's the future business model of the music industry. I wanted this to be a moral issue. I wanted this to be about freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and the killing of an emergent creativity and emergent literacy, all to sort of protect against what, quote unquote, piracy, you know. So, you know, I'd been talking to Greg, and one day turned out that he was going to be coming through Montreal. So I said, oh, why don't I come up to the show and film it? And that became one of the opening scenes of the film, and I thought, well, here's sort of the heart of the movie. Here's the pulse. Is this guy who you can see that, you know, at his performances, this sort of distinction between the art, the audience, and the creator is like forever destroyed, because as soon as he takes the stage, they take the stage with him, and it all becomes this kind of big party that they're creating together. And I thought that was a really good metaphor for what was happening, you know, with digital culture, with the audience beginning to take control. But I also saw it as an opportunity that he had kind of a narrative arc about how he was sort of increasing in his fame And also that by day he was working at that time as a biomedical engineer, and he was facing similar challenges in his work as a scientist with, you know, his research being blocked by patents as he was as a musician. I thought, well, that's too fucking good. So he followed up that, and he makes great music. So that's sort of how Greg became the kind of the pulse of the film.
One of the things that I learned watching the movie was how much as a society we don't understand the mechanics of our culture very well. And in the movie, you make an interesting contrast between Walt Disney, the person, and how he built up, started his entertainment company, and Walt Disney, the corporation, and how kind of new creative works aren't born in a vacuum. So could you talk about that a little bit? I thought that was one of the really most interesting things.
That's the sort of one of the central parts of the manifesto. The films are structured around this manifesto, and the first two points are basically that culture always builds on the past. That, you know, you can look through the history of the creation of music and art and science. These are always building on the ideas of those that came before. That's how we evolve as humans. We sort of keep moving forward and building. But what happens is that oftentimes once, like Walt Disney, he built on the past with, think about Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Pinocchio, Beauty and the Beast. All of these movies are based on fairy tales that he then adapted, because they were in the public domain and he could, into new works.
Well, and then there was Steamboat Willie, which was, I didn't realize, such a blatant ripoff of...
Yeah, Steamboat Willie was basically a mashup. You know, he was trying to come up with the first sound cartoon, and so what did he do? He looked around him, and he looked at what was a popular movie of the day, was Buster Keaton's Steamboat Bill. And the thing about Steamboat Bill was itself a mashup and itself a parody on a popular folk song called Steamboat Bill. That folk song is actually based on another song called Casey Jones that has the same melody structure and the same basic story structure. It's about a train conductor who saves the passengers by sacrificing the train car. Anyway, all of this cultural work had happened, all this music and these folk songs and then of course cinema. It was all building on kind of ideas of the day. And so that's what Walt did when he created Steamboat Willie. He looked at the Buster Keaton thing and said, hey, let's let people know that we're sort of winking at Buster Keaton. And in fact, the opening bars of the movie, what Mickey is whistling, he told his staff, go and rip off Steamboat Bill so people will know that, so that they'll recognize the song. He was playing, mashing up image and sound for the first time in cartoons. But then when Walt Disney died and the Walt Disney Corporation came, they said nobody else is allowed to do to the Walt Disney Corporation what they had done to the Brothers Grimm, and this whole remixing of art and culture. Walt Disney Corporation became the most litigious company in history in terms of copyright infringement. They sued, you know, kids for... the daycares for putting up, for drawing Mickey Mouse on the wall. They sued cartoonists like Dan O'Neill for drawing Mickey Mouse. They sued everybody. So that you see this all throughout history, even in cinema itself. I mean, the pioneers of Hollywood were escaping patents that Thomas Edison had placed on cinema technology. So they ran out there to the Wild West where Thomas Edison couldn't catch them. You look at the history of radio. Originally, radio didn't compensate musicians for when they played records on the air. You look at cable television. The original cable television companies didn't compensate the movie people when they put when they broadcast the movies on their cable networks. On and on. The VCR. You know, one generation is called pirates, and then they become the admirals, and then they don't want to allow anyone else to do what they've done.
One of the other interesting things about this whole endeavor is that you're eating your own dog food, in that you have open sourced your material, and you have a website. How did that idea come to you?
It was actually, you know, really early in the process. I was, you know, when you do your research, you sort of get out a whole bunch of books, and I think very early I had read two books. Lessig's book called The Future of Ideas, which was about how the internet was formed in sort of like this open source way. They didn't regulate it, and it was allowed to kind of bloom because of that, because anybody could kind of contribute to how it was created just through this open set of standards. But I was also reading Richard Stallman's Free Software, Free Society, which is his sort of book that explains the free software movement and how the creation of operating systems like Linux. And I thought, well, that would be such a cool way to make a film if you could do that, you know, like have these open-sourced sort of production models that people could see how the film was made by looking at the source code, you know, which I was like, well, that could be the footage. And they could change it if they wanted to. And that would basically be like editing. But this was in like 2002 or 2003. And you got to remember, this is before like YouTube is in like 2005. This is before video blogging, basically. This is before any of that. And I asked for money from like some funders. And they said, who would spend their time uploading a video to the internet? Who has time for that? And but we kind of plugged away, and the website as it exists now is basically like a blog on steroids. You know, like I post my rushes, and then I kind of we run it on this Drupal open source content management system. I post my stuff. People kind of browse through what they want. They download it. They remix it, and then they send it back. But what I kind of did early on in the process in production was we would create these sort of like missions. So I'm looking for something that's about the history of culture jamming. Here's some interviews with Negative Land and DJ Food and some stock footage. Have at her. And then people would send me responses, and then I would include those in the film. But I think the concept is kind of going to come full circle when we release the film online and sort of all the footage that made it. So that's sort of the focus of my work right now is to make that a reality. And so in like early next year, the whole film will be online, completely remixable.
Now, you got support for the film from the NFB. And this isn't a typical NFB project, you know, like with kind of the open source cinema and the topic matter, particularly in light of some of the current political times. How did that happen?
Well, the NFB, I mean, they're more than a funder of the film. They're a co-producer. So they're actually, you know, we're all in it together, which is cool. And it's different for a public institution. And, you know,
I guess I'm wondering, does the NFB understand Creative Commons? And like, did they know what they were signing up for?
Hell no. but they're pretty excited now that they've figured it out. The film board had a what they called a feature film fund, and they put out a call for ideas for films that could have theatrical releases, and that was done in partnership with the Documentary Channel. And that, which for us was just amazing, because as an independent documentary filmmaker, you spend, you know, half your time looking for, you know, any public funding that you can get, and the other half of your time looking for a broadcaster. Once you get a broadcaster, then some of the other kind of pieces fall into place. But that's sort of the big hurdle. The broadcasters really do operate as a bit of a gatekeeper. But here was this opportunity that you could get both of them at once. And so we really worked hard on an application, and at the end of the day, we were chosen with one other project from Toronto. We presented it in such a way that they felt that it could work for a broad audience. So that was pretty cool. And then, of course, that was several years ago. I think that was 2005 that all came together. But then the world has really changed since then, and of course this idea of having an open source documentary is really coming into fruition. You see the you know, the emergence of the social networks like MySpace and Facebook and of course, of YouTube, where you actually do have the audience creating their own media in a very profound and real way. So I think, you know, that the film board is sort of thrust into this role of working on a film that's a really participatory project, and it isn't normally the role of a public institution to sort of declare a position. So they're not. The film board's perspective on this is that they're creating a forum for debate, and that it's very clear what my position is, and I very much tip my hat to them for supporting the project and for realizing that, you know, it is the role of public institutions to kind of encourage a debate and encourage a discussion among citizens about what we're realizing is a really important issue. I mean, intellectual property is the mental environment. It's how we exchange ideas and how we build an economy for the future and what we want that to look like. And the decisions that we take are very much going to affect our children and our grandchildren and our economies of the future.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that comes out in the documentary is how people very much want to take all of this stuff they're consuming and make it their own, which is, in my mind, a very positive cultural message. You know, we aren't sitting by idly consuming the stuff. We're actively doing things with it and evolving it into other things. I found that very optimistic.
I do too, and I think it's very much it's the future of media. I don't think people want to just be consumers anymore. I think that, you know, we're many years into the revolution of television and just in the baby steps of the revolution of the internet. And I don't think it's any surprise that people are beginning to speak these languages themselves. People understand the language of media and they want to react to it. You know, it's like the line from Negative Land in the film. It's like nobody asks us when we walk down the street or when we go to a dentist's office or when we eat in a restaurant or when we look anywhere in our homes or when we watch public television on the CBC. Nobody asks us if we want to receive these corporate images. So why in the hell do we have to ask any of them to take a little bit of that, our shared heritage, and make something out of it and actually use it to say what we want to say? To react how we want to react. I mean, that just like seems to me like a basic human right is to take the world that exists around you and as an artist and react to it.
Now you mentioned earlier that you do have distribution. When and where can people watch RIP, A Remix Manifesto?
Well, for folks in BC, it's playing at the Whistler Film Festival on Friday. This is Friday, December 5th. We have plans for some university tours coming up very quickly. It's playing at the Rendezvous Cinema Quebecois out here and, you know, some other film festivals around the world and around North America. And then what our plans are is to kind of catch our breath and to prepare a release on the internet and on television at the exact same time. So we'll show on the documentary channel in Canada, as well as Canada and Quebec. And then, of course, it will be available as a free download online as soon as we sort of cross all those T's.
Excellent. And you've won an award already.
Yeah, we won two awards. We won the special jury prize here in Montreal at the Festival of Nouveau Cinema. But we just won a really fun and awesome one at the International Documentary Festival at Amsterdam, which is like a sort of like the gathering of the tribes for documentary filmmakers, come from around the world, and they show 300 films from I don't know how many countries, and our film won the Audience Choice Award there. So that was really thrilling and touching for this film, you know, because it's about audience. Well, people we used to call the audience anyway. It's about how we're all the creators of culture. So it was a nice recognition, for sure.
Excellent. So just really quickly, shoot us the URLs for the appropriate websites.
There's two. There's the URL for the film itself is NFB, National Film Board, nfb.ca/rip. And then if you want to take part in the film and check out the ways you can participate, that's at opensourcecinema.org.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for talking with us, Brett, and best of luck.
Thanks, Dale.
And that was Dale's conversation with Brett Gaylor, the director of RIP, A Remix Manifesto. As mentioned earlier, RIP is currently making the festival rounds in his next screening at Le Rendezvous du Cinéma Québécois on February the 18th. To get more information about the film and to find out about a screening near you, be sure to head on over to their official website at the National Film Board, that's nfb.ca, or you can come by Row 3. I have put a link to the film's website in the show notes for this episode. Music for today's show provided by Girl Talk. You can get more information about the band and hear more tracks at their official website, located at myspace.com/girltalk. As for us, be sure to stay tuned to Row3.com for all your movie news and reviews, and tune in to the next episode of After the Credits for more insightful and entertaining discussion on film. Until next time, we'll see you after the credits.
Play your part. My bitch a choosing lover. Never fuck without a rubber. Never in the sheets like it on top of the cover. Money on the dresser. Drive a compressor. Top notch hoes get the most, not the lesser. Trash like the fuck with $40 in the club. Fucking up the game, bitch, it gets no love. She be cross country giving all that you got. A thousand a pop, I'm pulling pillars off the lot. I smashed up the gray one, bought me a red. Every time we hit the parking lot, we turn head. Some hoes wanna choose, but them bitches too scary. If your bitch chose me, you ain't a pimp, you a fairy.
Fuck 'em, let 'em lay. Where I'm from, we see a fucking dead body every day.